The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest greatest adventures from life on planet Porky, with myself, the Porkmeister, and the rock chick writer extraordinaire, of course, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, hot on the heels, back from St. Bride's, where you were officiating at the Harvest Festival service. I love Harvest Festivals. When I was a kid, we used to go to Sunday school to a church on Hoole Road in Chester. And the one weekend of the year I really loved was when we all took something Mum had cooked at home and put it on the table, you know, for the food for little Jesus and all that. Is it still like that?
Not quite. In the old days, we used to turn up at church, didn't we, with cabbages and carrots, yes, and parsnips and all the wonderful produce that we grew on our allotments and so on.
That's right.
Or the parents
Well, that was all about we plough the fields and scatter the good seed on the ground. I remember it.
Something like that, yes. Yeah. We always do have that hymn. But because nowadays, I mean, certainly with our church, it's a non-residential parish, meaning that it's on Fleet Street, nobody lives around there. So we don't have an immediate parish to distribute these goods to. So we collect non-perishable goods nowadays.
Oh, okay.
That go to the Bishop of London's fund to assist people in need.
Oh, okay.
It's more tins and packets and toiletries and that kind of thing nowadays.
You talk about packets. I had an old auntie in Birkenhead. We used to go and see her about once a year.
That's a bit rude calling her a packet.
A packet. No, she was a packet. But for some unknown reason, we always used to take her a packet of tea. I don't know why. I mean, obviously, it was after the Second World War. And I think, you know, I was born in the year when there was still rationing, believe it or not. That's how old I am. And so the things people wanted, basics, like, you know, oh, bring me a packet of butter or bring me a packet of tea. And tea was loose in those days. It wasn't in tea bags. So I remember that very well. But anyway, those were the days, as they say. Modern life isn't much fun, is it, Miss Jones? I mean, crikey, you know, I'm terrified to switch on the television in case any more bad news comes blaring out the screen, all that kind of stuff, you know, really drives me mad.
The trouble is, it becomes a bit of an obsession, doesn't it? An obsession to watch it to begin with.
Yeah.
And then an obsession not to watch it because it's just, it seems like it's getting worse and worse and worse by the day.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, you know, my routine has always been to watch the 6 o'clock news at night on BBC, then 6:30 on ITN, then 7 o'clock on Sky if I've not been in earlier to watch it. And now, after watching about 15 minutes of BBC News, I think I can't take any more. You know, let's watch last night's Coronation Street or something. At least that's all made up. You know what I mean? But I don't know. Reminds me a bit, you know, this power struggle in Parliament. It reminds me a bit of the Fleet Street days, because there were all these great power struggles in Fleet Street, weren't there?
Well, and that seems to date back hundreds of years. It seems that Fleet Street has all, when you read the history, that it's always been a sort of sewer of opposition and discontent.
Yes.
So it's quite interesting that the newspaper industry flourished there and lasted there for such a long time.
Yeah, well,
Somebody drew a kind of parallel between the River Fleet, or the Fleet River, as it's sometimes called, which obviously runs underground now. And I read one report that said that water ran so bright and clear. But then the newspapers came in and it became a sewer.
Well, it wasn't just that. It's just that the ink ran out of the buildings into the River Fleet. The River Fleet, you're right, in the Middle Ages was a river where Fleet Street is now. And it ran down to from the site of St. Paul's, the site of what St. Paul's is now. And then over the years, yes, it got filled up with trash and all that kind of stuff. And they just sort of filled it in with soil and that kind of stuff. But it was the ink that got in there. But no, I was talking about the power struggles there. I remember how people used to battle so hard to get a top job. You know what I mean? Everybody wanted to be an executive and all that. I remember one time a guy called Bob somebody, can't remember his surname. He was the editor of the Express. He got sacked and everybody hated him. So they all started mocking and reviling him. He went to the Mirror and, you know, if they saw him in the street, they'd give him a hard time. And lo and behold, 4 months later, the proprietor had a change of mind and brought him back. So then half a dozen people who reveled in his demise were suddenly out. I mean, that's the sort of place Fleet Street was, you know.
Very personally vindictive.
Yeah.
You know, there was always some kind of private fight on between people, that they would be angling to get rid of each other and so on. Yeah. A lot of backstabbing, even to the point that the pub opposite my dad's office, which was the old Mirror building, up at Holborn Circus, I think it was called the White Hart.
It was the White Hart.
Used to call that pub the Stab.
It was called the Stab.
Because it's where you were taken to be stabbed in the back. Mm.
That is absolutely true. It was the White Hart, but it wasn't even known as a stab in the back. It was just the Stab. And if you were invited over there for a word with, you know, some executive editor or something, you never came out, so to speak. Another guy once, and he's probably still alive, and I got on very well with him. He was called Alan Frame, and he was the sort of executive editor features on the Express.
I remember him.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he had a silver beard type thing. Very nice chap.
Very silver fox type.
Yeah, silver fox type and all that. And anyway, there was a vacancy for the editor of the Sunday Express, and we were all in the same building in Fleet Street, obviously, you know. And people were being interviewed, and then suddenly Alan came back into the newsroom, invited everybody to the pub. And he said, "I can make an announcement now. I've just come out of the chairman's office. I'm the new editor of the Sunday Express." And we said, "Oh, well done, Alan," you know. And so this went on for 3 or 4 hours. Then another guy came in whose name I've forgotten. I can't, he was okay, but he was a bit more slippery, you know what I mean? He was sort of working in the background a bit. And he came in with a load of people and started buying drinks at the other end of the bar. And Alan said, "Oh, I wonder what, I wish I could remember the guy's name. Wonder what they're celebrating." So I went over and I said, "Oh, hi." And I shook hands with the guy, you know, who I'm talking about. He said, "Oh, I've just been made editor of the Sunday Express." So I went back and I said, "What's that all about?" And I said, "Well, you won't believe this, Alan, but he says he's just been made editor of the Sunday Express. He's just seen the chairman." He said, "What? That man's an idiot, you know." So Alan goes over and said, "What are you talking about?" Alan disappears from the pub. It was the Popping Jay, which was on the ground floor of the Daily Express building.
The Express pub,
Express pub, that's right, yeah. He went back upstairs and came back and he was virtually in tears. There'd been some kind of mistake and the other guy had been made editor of the Sunday Express. I mean, that's a...
What a horrible story. I mean, that's the kind of thing, humiliating people.
Yeah, yeah.
Newspapers were very good at that, weren't they?
Oh, absolutely. You never got a call. You only found out that you'd lost your job when you went into work and your locker had been removed or something like that. You know what I mean?
Or your stuff was in a box on the floor beside your desk or something.
Yeah, absolutely. But
were you ever fired from Fleet Street?
Not Fleet Street, but then the next building was the one over Blackfriars Bridge. I got sacked as the news editor there after 6 years. Because Sir Nicholas Lloyd said, you know, I was getting worn out. What he meant was I'd started shouting at people a bit more because, you know, you do get irritated after a number of years. But I didn't mind too much. I went back to America and followed Bill Clinton around America in his first election triumph and got to know Bill Clinton quite well. And I kept sending dispatches back saying, "This guy's going to win." And everybody said, "Don't be ridiculous. You know, what do you know about politics?" I said, "No, I'm telling you." I said, he's out on the road all the time. The crowd's warmed him. And his opponent was George Bush Sr., you know, the father of George W. Bush. George H. Bush, I think, was the senior guy. And he had such a huge lead in the polls because he'd won the war in Iraq, okay, Desert Storm. He had such a huge lead, he didn't bother going out campaigning at all. And I could see the polls moving. Anyway, I got it completely right, and there you go. And I remained a friend of Bill Clinton's until the night before the election, when all of a sudden I couldn't call him on his what we call a cell phone in America anymore. The numbers just disappeared, and that was the last time I ever had any contact with him. But anyway,
after all that you did for him, he dropped you like a stone.
Oh yeah, I know, it's terrible, isn't it? But there we are.
That's shocking behaviour.
Absolutely shocking behaviour. I totally agree. Now, Miss Jones, we can't have a Life on Planet Porky without a Beatles story, of course. And what about this amazing story I came across, which I talked to you about just last night, and you told me more about it. But I had a meeting in town yesterday. I was talking to someone, and they said, "Oh, Mike, you're a Beatles fan, aren't you?" I said, "Yes, yeah." Have you ever heard this story, which I picked up somewhere? I don't know, somebody he'd spoken to in the music business, and I said, "No, what is it?" He said, "Well, Cynthia Lennon," and I've read her book years ago. It's called A Twist of Lennon, okay? And it was only a little thin paperback, but it was a story of her life with John, obviously. She had a load of letters that had been written to her by John Lennon from Hamburg, and they were love letters to the extent that John Lennon could ever write a love letter, if you see what I mean. You know more about that than I do. And she went to an auction house and put them up for auction. And this was years later. It was after the Beatles had split up. And Paul McCartney found out they were for sale. Unknown to her, he was the anonymous bidder to buy the letters. So McCartney sent somebody along to the auction, bought the letters, and then a week or two later, the letters arrived back at Cynthia's cottage in North Wales with a note attached to them saying, "These should be yours forever. Lots of love, Paul." Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is the kind of thing that Paul McCartney did and does. You know, he's a very big-hearted guy, and I imagine the romantic in Paul would have thought, well, that's terrible. You know, she shouldn't have to part with those letters from the guy who was the love of her life, who was now a global superstar. As I understand it, she later on sold them again anyway, because Cynthia was always strapped for cash.
She was, yeah, poor girl.
She made a few sort of ill-advised marriages after she did, and John split up. Yeah. It never really worked out for Cynthia. And she was reduced to doing things like designing bed linen. And she opened a little nightclub, a restaurant nightclub in Upper St Martin's Lane called Lennon's.
Right. She also
she was always sort of driven to try and make herself some money, because she didn't get much from John.
Golly, what a shame that is. I think she opened a little place in North Wales as well. Because
it was a hotel. Yeah, that's where she and Julian were living when John was murdered.
Yeah, of course, that's right. Yeah, my God. Wouldn't you have thought that Lennon, with all his wealth and riches, might have just looked after her a little bit better? But anyway, look, how can you comment on other people's lives? You can't really, can you?
Well, I think her settlement was about 100 grand, which, as we know, goes nowhere.
Well, that wasn't bad, I suppose.
She got 100,000, I think, and custody of Julian, which tells you everything, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does a bit, yeah. Of course, McCartney showed his compassion for that marriage breakup by driving over to see them, and got the idea for Hey Jude, didn't he? Because he was
Julian has not recently changed his name, and he's now known as Jude Lennon.
Is he really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, quite recently. He's got a new album out.
Oh, I think he is 60 years of age, isn't he? Can you imagine John Lennon something?
It's terrifying how these children age, isn't it? But a friend of mine, Tony Moore, has written a song on that album as well.
Really?
Which it's credited as a co-write to Tony and Julian, but actually Tony wrote it, and I think Julian added about two words.
Yeah, well,
I first heard that song about 3 years ago. I was round at Tony's for dinner,
really?
And he got up and he went to his keyboard and he said, "Listen to this," and just played this beautiful song.
Yeah.
And now here it is on a Julian Lennon album.
Wow, fantastic. Okay, folks, we will talk about things other than the Beatles, but we've got to go on to this other great story. It's the anniversary or the birthday or something like that of a guy called William Pablo Farke Darby. So, and he's not alive anymore because he was a circus ringmaster.
Yeah, his name was William Darby, and he took the pen name, as it were, of Pablo Funk.
Anyway, he was a ringmaster about 200 years ago, but the anniversary has come round of his birth or something. But he was the guy who put out a poster advertising his circus, and John Lennon walked into an antique shop, didn't he? And the rest is history.
It's a great story, because this was this chap, William Darby, was the first recorded black circus owner in Britain.
Oh.
And this was during the golden age of the circus, during Victorian times.
Yeah.
And yes, the circus used to travel around the country, and they would put posters out, you know, the same as they put posters out today for circus performances. And John Lennon, when the Beatles were filming a promotional film, we didn't even call them videos in those days, for Strawberry Fields in Knole Park in Sevenoaks, which was a hunting park for Henry VIII in the old days.
Right.
And I used to live in Sevenoaks when my eldest was a very little girl.
Yeah.
And we used to go to Knole Park every day. Yeah. That's the park, if you remember, in 87, when we had the great storm and it lost a million trees in one night.
And they couldn't call it Sevenoaks anymore because there were only two or something, weren't there?
Well, those Sevenoaks used to stand around the cricket ground.
Yeah.
And six of them fell during that storm.
Shocking.
Yeah. But this this poster, John found a framed poster in a Sevenoaks antique shop.
Yeah.
And it was talking about being for the benefit of Mr. Kite.
Mm.
And Mr. Kite and Mr. Henderson were trapeze artists.
Golly, fantastic.
But this song, I mean, very unusual song, a very kind of quaintly stylish song, really, written by John, but credited to both John and Paul, as all the songs were.
Yeah.
There was a line in it referring to Henry the Horse.
That's right, yeah.
And that was perceived as a reference to heroin, which we all know now John Lennon was addicted to heroin at one point. And so the BBC banned the song. It wasn't able to be played over the air.
Good God, because they banned, on the same album, they banned Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds because they said it was about LSD. But it wasn't, was it? It was about Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, painted by...
Well, the jury's out on that, But
seems an amazing coincidence, I have to say.
Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, when was it released? 1967.
Yeah.
Those were... unenlightened times, let's see.
Yeah. Well, no, I think some of the most brilliant music the Beatles ever composed was definitely done under the influence. That's well known, isn't it? And mind-bending substances and all that. But no, Mr. Kite, let me just think of the first lines. For the benefit of Mr. Kite, there will be a show tonight on trampoline. That's the one, isn't it? You know, the Hendersons.
You even sound a bit like John Lennon there.
Yeah, thank you. The Hendersons will all be there. Lady Pablo Frank Astaire. I couldn't understand why it was Frank Astaire, not Fred Astaire. But then I looked at the poster and there is a bloke called Frank Astaire on the poster who's one of the performers.
Yeah, a bit ahead of Fred Astaire's time, I think.
It was, But, no, absolutely amazing. And then I assume that George Martin put in all the fairground sounds, you know what I mean? Like the steam engine and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, it's wondrously deep and evocative, that track. It's just, it's a whole maelstrom of sounds. And you can almost smell the place, can't you? You can almost smell the sawdust in.
Yeah.
And, George did an amazing job producing that.
You can, you can feel the gravel under your feet in the fairground yard and all that kind of stuff, you know what I mean? But, no, absolutely fantastic. Now then, Miss Jones, have you got a pressure cooker?
No. God, those went up with the art,
didn't they? No, no, they're coming back. This is the point I was going to make. Now, apparently, with energy crises and all that kind of stuff, the way you can really save now cooking your food is get yourself a pressure cooker. I mean, I remember my mum's pressure cooker, and I think I'm right in saying that it whistled when everything was ready, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. And people used to leave them on all day and go out to work.
Yes.
But they were incredibly dangerous things. They used to blow up.
That's right. I know. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, basically, it was a sealed sort of pan, wasn't it? It was a big, thick sort of steel pan and a lid on it, which was the lid couldn't lift up with the steam, the lid.
It twisted. The lid twisted. I can see it now.
Yes.
You really brought it back. I can see it now on the cooker in my mum's kitchen.
That's right. And then you could leave it on for hours, and then you're sitting there watching the telly, you hear this whistling noise, you thought, oh, right, the food's ready. That's the pressure cooker. Anyway, I only mention it because I see there being sale. But the thing I'm going to get, I'm determined to get, because I keep reading people saying how brilliant it is it called an air fryer or something, where you can stick a chicken in and an hour later it's all done, nice and crispy?
People are raving about these air fryers on Twitter every day, and I don't really know what they are.
Well, I don't, but I'm going to find out. I think it's like a pressure cooker, but it's not, if you see what I mean. It's like a, well, you know the space where you've got your microwave? Throw out your microwave and bring in your air fryer, I'm told, because it's more use.
I use my microwave every day.
I've never used my microwave.
Have you not?
I've got two microwaves, and I'm just frightened of it. I just think, you know, it's wrong to put food into a microwave and it goes in cold and comes out hot 20 seconds later.
Well, why is that wrong? It's the same as an oven, but quicker.
Yeah, but I don't like it. You can always tell, in my view, it doesn't happen so much now, but in my view, you always tell when you've got microwave food in pubs, if you're having a pub lunch, because it's so incredibly hot and never cools down. And I think...
But what do you think you're eating on an aircraft?
Oh, I don't like to think about it, to be honest.
I mean, that's all microwaved, yeah, or nuked, as my brother would say.
Yeah, well, you're probably right. But I prefer the traditional, you know, long, slow roast. In fact, last weekend I had a roast fillet of beef, I think, and I just like to leave it in for, you know, an hour or two hours probably, and smell the wafting aroma of the beef going around the kitchen into the house and all that, you know, and...
But that is costing you a fortune in energy.
Well, probably, but...
You know, your microwave is your friend right now, yeah, when energy prices are through the roof.
Yeah, well, no, you may well be right. Now, talking about pop stars and one individual, Christa Burr is 74 as we're making this this podcast. I don't want to be unkind to him, but did he only ever make one record, Lady in Red?
No, he did not only make one record. He's had a hugely successful career.
Really?
I gather he's sold 45 million plus albums around the world.
My God, yeah.
Do you not remember the great song, Don't Pay the Ferryman?
Yeah, but that was a faster one. Don't Pay the Ferryman.
Well, what difference does that make? It was still a hit.
Yeah, but I thought he did like ballads, you know what I mean?
No, not only ballads at all, but that was a great track, indelible track.
Yeah.
And he also did one of the great Christmas records. Came out originally in 1976, wasn't a hit.
Yeah.
Re-released it in the 80s. It was a massive hit.
What was it?
Called A Spaceman Came Travelling.
Oh, I love that record. I listened to that at Christmas, and it's about a spaceman who comes to Earth at Christmas to wish us all, you know, goodwill and all that kind of stuff.
It is. It's got such a beautiful chorus. I'm no great fan of Christa Berg. I think he's a bit of a prat, to be honest.
All
but
right.
I absolutely love, I can't stand A Lady in Red. Oh, my God.
No, I can't.
But A Spaceman Came Travelling is so cool. It was cool when it came out, and it's timeless.
I didn't know that.
It is on all the Christmas compilations, as you say.
Yeah.
It's a bit like Jonah Louie. You know, we forget about Jonah Louie all year.
Yeah.
And then we've got, what's it called? Wish I Could Be Home for Christmas.
Wish I Could Be Home for Christmas.
Yeah, with a sort of military beat to it.
Yeah,
you know, that's Jonah Louie.
I know that one. Well, you only ever hear of Chris Rea at Christmas, don't you? Travelling home for Christmas. Well, apart from...
Driving home for Christmas. So you'd see these great apps that go round, do the rounds at Christmas.
Yeah.
And everybody asking on Twitter, is he there yet?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Travelling Home for Christmas. Of course, he did one of the great records of all time, didn't he? The Road to Hell.
Oh, what a voice. What a voice that guy has. That is one of my top 100.
Yeah, I agree. It's written about the...
Do you do this thing now? I keep a notebook. I must be getting old.
Yeah.
I keep a notebook because I want to make a compilation of all my favourite all-time tracks.
Okay.
And every time I hear one on the radio or somewhere that I think, oh, God, yeah, I used to love that song, rush home, scribble it in the notebook, and I'm up to about 400 odd songs now.
Well, surely there's a book there, isn't there, Miss Jones? Because what you'll do is one of these days is you'll print your top 500 and then give us a little biog of each one and how it came to be, you know what I mean?
It's a very subjective thing, though, isn't it? Everybody has their favourites, and one man's meat is another man's poison. Tell you what I heard on the radio a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
must have been on Steve Wright Love Songs on Sunday, actually. Mm-hmm. And it was Peter Sarsgaard's Where Do You Go To, My Love?
Oh, I love it.
Do you remember that
song? I love
it, yeah. My father loved that song. Right. It really reminds me of my dad. Mm. By the time the song was finished, I was driving along in tears.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And the great thing about that record, you've got no sort of basic musical structure on it. So it's an accordion. Yes. There's a guitar, and at the end, when the really emotional bit kicks in, you've got, I think, one or maybe two cellos. Mm. That is it. There's no drums on it. No. There's no bass, nothing. But it's such an evocative song. Oh,
I totally agree. There's a line in the middle. Remember the back streets of Naples when you were a child in rags. And it gives you this evocative image of a Sophie Loren-like figure growing up in poverty in Italy, but rising to stardom. You know what I mean?
Two little kids, yeah, from back streets in Napoli. Yeah. One of them kind of stays where he is, but this was obviously the love of his life. Yeah. And the other one, through dint of great beauty, goes on to be a society figure in Paris.
Amazing.
And she's got a racehorse from the Aga Khan.
That's
and
right.
She stole a painting from Picasso and all
yeah.
of this.
Oh, yeah.
And it's how you sort of reinvent yourself, yeah. but you can never get away from the person you started out as.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Hi, everybody. I'm going to brighten up your day by telling you about Harry's. The fantastic shaving experience. They're not just the super sharp razor company. They are much, much more. And you can start with a trial set that is absolutely free. You just have to pay for delivery. In your trial pack, you get the unique, engineered and weighted Harry's handle, a 5-blade cartridge, complete with precision trimmer, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade cover if you're on the move. Plus, a free hydrating night spray of lotion. Absolutely everything you need for that very smooth shave. Your trial set is packaged in beautiful aquamarine containers that let you know you're in for something special. The weighted handle makes you feel you're holding something more than just a razor. And you are. The trimmer blade makes it so easy to get to those hard-to-reach places. The foaming shave gel makes the blade skim across your face like a skater on an ice rink. And after a couple of splashes of night lotion, you'll feel your skin positively invigorated and looking healthier. Now, Harry's products are put together with 0% sulfates or dyes and are alcohol-free. Absolutely nothing to cause concern. Everything is crafted by the experts who've devised invigorating formulas. And you will feel the difference no matter what your skincare goals are. Believe me, you're a winner every time. So, folks, make sure to support our podcast, Life on Planet Porky, and start your own skincare journey by redeeming a free Harry's trial set. All you cover is £3.95 for your delivery. So here are the details. Just head to harrys.com/Porky and have your trial set and free night lotion delivered to your door. I'll give you that one more time. That's harrys.com/Porky.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Okay, folks, thank you for tuning in again to Life on Planet Porky, myself, the Portmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, did you ever fancy being a wag?
No, but my grandmother was one of the world's first wags.
What? Nuts.
Yes. Very, very glamorous lady who used to go to football dressed in a two-piece suit with a brooch and a hat and her gloves. Yeah. When my grandmother used to walk out on the stand, first of all at Everton and then at Southend United, the men around the stand all used to get to their feet and applaud her. She was one of the world's first wags. Her name was Nancy Jones.
Good God, that's amazing. The reason I mention it is because my very good friend Lizzie Cundy, who's often been given the title Queen of the Wags, has written the guide to being a wag as the World Cup approaches in a month's time. But Lizzie does point out, and this is the point of me raising this, it's the World Cup coming up in Qatar. Lizzie does point out that you've got to watch yourself, even as a wag in Qatar. Illegal to drink alcohol. Wags will be made to dress modestly. No short skirts. Any public display of affection will not be tolerated, pending you being arrested. Phone pictures outside official buildings are strictly off limits. No loud music or belting out tunes during the twice daily call to prayer. Now, all that is taking place in Qatar, and it's just another reason, and you and I have had conversations about this before, why I think Qatar is a totally unsuitable location for this World Cup. Problems are piling up there.
I can't believe it's going ahead. I'm really quite offended by the whole thing. But I tell you what offended me more was, is it the Emirates or Qatar Air or one of these airlines suddenly pops up on television with the drum beat for We Will Rock You, the Queen track. And I'm thinking, why the hell did they sell the rights to that?
Yeah.
It offends every cell in my body to hear that advertising a Middle Eastern airline and anything to do with the World Cup. They are cashing in and they don't need to do that.
Well, Qatar Airlines are certainly sponsoring some weather reports at the moment. I think the other one is Emirates, so I'm not sure which one the tune's.
Whichever one it is, it really offends me. Yeah. I think Freddie Mercury must be turning in his grave.
Yeah, probably.
He would really have disapproved of this.
I'm sure he would. Just to explain to millions of our listeners, you know, reports come out of Qatar that up to 6,000 workers have perished whilst in the process of building the stadiums they need for the World Cup, which starts on November the 20th next month. And those stadiums will probably never, ever be used again. And they've literally cost billions to build. It's what's known as a sports washing exercise. It's, you know, Qatar's one of the wealthiest countries in the world, if not the wealthiest. It's got greater reserves of gas than Russia. And all they want to do is try and improve their image and make themselves more approachable to the world for the day that the gas runs out. They want to become a huge tourist spot and they want to have huge competitions. They're applying, I think, to hold the Olympic Games in about sort of three games times and all that kind of stuff. But it offends a lot of people. And a lot of people are asking why David Beckham has taken 150 quid, allegedly. It's something like
150 million pounds.
I'm going mad. 150 million. I've read a report saying he's taken 150 million over 10 years or something like that. And Gary Neville, who I've a lot of respect for and is very straightforward and straight-talking and avowed socialist and supporter of the Labour Party, I think, is going out there to work for beIN, which is the Qatar national broadcaster. And there are very strict rules in Qatar about, for instance, homosexuality is, I'm told, illegal. And that if you're seen in the street holding hands with somebody of the same sex, you could be arrested. I mean, it's not a very pleasant place, is it?
No, not at all. I do not understand why we have turned a blind eye to all of this. We should have said right at the outset, we refuse to go.
Yeah, well,
sorry, but we should have taken a stand. We're better than that.
Well, it's all about money, as you well know. And the interesting thing is, you don't read a lot about, you know, criticism of David Beckham or Gary Neville, but that's because both ITV and BBC in this country have got rights to the World Cup, and it is the biggest deal in the world in terms of raising revenues, advertising and all that kind of stuff. So I do think it's all about commercial considerations, you know.
Yeah, well, let's hope they read out the names of the 6,000 workers who died building the stadium at the start of the tournament. Bet they don't.
Yeah, well, no, you're absolutely right. The other issue, of course, is that we kick off against Iran. Now, you know.
Yeah, again, we should have taken a stand on this. We should not be going ahead with that match.
You know, I can't hardly disagree with you there for two reasons. Of course, there's terrible things happening on the streets in Iran. Women are being persecuted. They're being jailed. They've even been killed. But the latest we've read is that Ukraine is now being bombarded by things called suicide drones, which it is said are being supplied to Putin in Russia by Iran. I mean, it's all very old.
So sanctions are subjective in that case. You know, we can object to this, but we'll turn a blind eye to that because it's not in our best interests to say anything. Yeah. I think this is disgraceful on every level. Mm. I watched on the news last night a climber, an Iranian climber, female, who's a champion, who had climbed in some competition, I can't remember the name of it, without the hijab.
Yeah.
Her head covering.
She said it fell off.
And she said it fell off. But what is going to be the outcome of that now?
Exactly, yeah. Now she's been, has she been arrested by the state or something?
Well, I think she's been disappeared.
Oh, disappeared, dear me. Oh, dear. Thank God we live in the UK with all these problems we've got. At least we're a civilised country. Talking about climbers, by the way, right. I got really angry at the start of this week because this guy goes and climbs up the bridge on the Dartford Crossing.
Oh, don't even get me started.
No, it's one of Britain's major arteries of traffic because it flows across the River Thames from north to south, you know, I think it's through Essex. And the reason I got so angry is that, you know, protesters drive me mad anyway because, you know, a very small number of people can cause major, major problems for thousands, tens of thousands of others for a protest which is special to them but not very special to anybody else. That annoys me. But this guy is a professional road bridge engineer. He climbed up on the bridge. He clearly, from all the pictures we saw, had safety harnesses all around him. He couldn't possibly have fallen off. So why did we stop all the traffic? Why?
I was stuck on the M25 for 4.5 hours.
Well, because of this guy?
Yes, because all the roads surrounding, it's not just the road that goes towards the Queen Elizabeth II Bridge, but all the backlog facing in every direction, miles and miles of traffic. Imagine the millions lost in working hours, in goods not being able to get to their destination, meat probably going off and having to be thrown away. Yeah. Not to mention ambulances that couldn't get through to hospitals.
Yeah. Yeah, what about the pollution of thousands of cars standing, you know, still with their engines switched on hour after hour after hour? I mean,
it would have been much worse than what they were trying to prevent,
exactly,
I'm sure.
Exactly. Honestly, it drives me absolutely mad. You know, we're too tolerant in this country. I don't want a police state. I don't want police walking around with batons and you know, cracking skulls of people who are sitting in the road with their hands glued to the tarmac. But I do want us to get, you know, very, very much more positive about trying to stop this thing happening. I say to them all the time, whenever I meet them, oh, I see, what is it, just stop oil. I tell you what, why don't you go to the world's biggest oil producer, that's Saudi Arabia, and why don't you sit in the streets in Riyadh and glue your hands to the tarmac there and find out what happens to you then? You would never be seen again, would you?
No, not at all. Yeah. I think, yes, I agree with the right to protest.
Yes, I do.
But I think the right to protest, which wrecks other people's lives, should be against the law.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And also there should be punitive measures. You know, they should be fined big amounts of money. You find out that a lot of them are middle class, have got nice houses and all that, which they go back to. They don't seem to work. And it just, whole blinking thing drives me mad, honestly. But as I say,
I do have sympathy for the eco problem.
Yeah.
I do think, you know, we have turned a blind eye for 30 odd years. We knew this was coming. Our governments have done nothing. So I have sympathy for the cause.
Yeah.
But I think there are ways of doing it.
Yeah,
this is not the way to disrupt everybody's life and make us all angry.
I totally agree. And when people get angry, they lose the focus on what the protest was all about, don't they? They just get angry. I mean, look, people are often accusing me of being, you're a climate change denier. I'm not. I just like to have a discussion about why the climate is changing and how we can adapt to it and how far we have to deprive ourselves of energy in order to, you know, maintain the standard of living we've all worked for all our lives. But that's probably another story. Getting back to pop music for a minute, Miss Jones, and
Oh, less.
Your book, The Stone Age, of course, is still on the shelves. I saw it in Waterstones the other day, so there'll be a lot of people buying that for Christmas. And funnily enough, I read last night that the Rolling Stones have gone into a studio in New York and made a first new record for 18 years.
Oh, yeah, it's not going to trouble the charts, I don't think. I mean, yeah, there's a reason why the Stones haven't done anything for 18 years, isn't there?
They don't need to. I mean,
resting on the laurels of their back catalogue.
Exactly.
And always will.
Yeah, exactly.
When you go to a Stones concert, if you go to a Stones concert, you don't want to hear tracks from the first album for 18 years. You want to hear Jumping Jack Flash, Honky Tonk Women, Satisfaction, you know. You want a nostalgia trip. That's why you go to see the Rolling Stones.
Yeah. No,
you don't want to hear the new stuff.
No, I totally agree. Unfortunately, I went to an Elton John concert once, and it was at the old Wembley Stadium, and we were very young. I don't think we were students, but if we weren't, it was a couple of years afterwards. I think it was probably a newspaper reporter in Chester, a big adventure to go down to London. And, you know, there was tarpaulins all over the pitch and sitting on the pitch at Wembley and eating, I remember, bread and cheese, which we bought in a local bakery, and swigging bottles of beer. And it was Elton John and the Beach Boys, believe it or not. And Elton John came on, and I knew a few of the Elton John songs. I think the first one was My Song. I think that was his first hit, you know. And
Even Your Song.
Is it Your Song, My Song?
Your Song.
Yeah, we wrote with Bernie Taupin. But he came on in a spandex, is it, outfit, you know, a glittery sort of thing that...
Lurex, probably, yeah.
Lurex, that's right, yeah. And then the stadium was completely silent for the next 40 minutes, while he played six tracks from his new album. And it was the most bizarre. You know, we all thought, are we sure this is Elton John? You know what I mean? Because you shouldn't do that. I spoke to Rod Stewart once, who said the only songs I ever do at a concert are the old favourites. That's what people want. They don't want anything else. And I've seen Billy Joel say exactly the same. He said, I haven't written a song for 30 years because people wouldn't want to hear it. They just want to hear the songs from my heyday.
Of course. And so... you've got a show in Las Vegas, which has been running for about 10 years now, which was devised, conceived and produced by my great friend Simon Napier-Bell, who used to be a famous rock manager, managed the Yardbirds, Mark Bolan, Wham, and George Michael as a solo artist.
Yeah.
And he went to a rock gig one night, and realized that the audience reacted to only about two of the songs. Mm. Forget which even the band it was.
Right.
But he thought, that's the point. People go to a live show not to try out the new music that they don't know they might like yet.
Yes.
They want to hear the hits of old, the music that they woke up to, the music that they were young to.
Yeah, yeah.
So he put together this show called Raiding the Rock Vaults,
yeah.
which is a super group on stage in Las Vegas, in a venue in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And you get to hear, it's all original musicians from all the great rock groups who happen not to be touring at that time.
Right.
And they all come together as this supergroup to perform the rock hits, you know, the great sort of indelible hits of yore. And it's a massively successful show.
Golly, fantastic. Yeah, that's the way to do it. Miss Jones, tell me this. Is your house full of IKEA furniture?
No.
Well, you said that with a near. No, how dare you?
I don't think I've got anything from IKEA.
Really?
I might have the old rug.
Oh, right. Well, it's good news for you then, because this is the headline here. IKEA could cost you dear. IKEA could cost you dear. That's not a very...
You're a poet and you know it.
That's right, yeah. Prices soar by up to 80% at flat pack chain as raw material costs rocket. And it tells you all these great things, like a table and four chairs with an antique stain on it, which last year cost £99, is this year costing £179. So this disappoints me because my house is full of IKEA stuff. You know, I go to a huge IKEA in sort of South London, a bit up from Stockbroker Belt, Surrey, where I live.
And oh, I know where that one is, Pearly.
That's it. It's got a huge chimney with the yellow and blue, logo around the top of the chimney.
Two chimneys there.
Say again?
There's two chimneys.
Two chimneys, are there? Oh, right. I've only ever noticed one. Never mind. And you pile it all into the back of the car and come home. And as I am talking to you here from my office, I'm surrounded by what's called the Billy Bookcase, because the Billy Bookcase is their most famous product, I think, although I can't see it in this list of things that have gone up. But they're so easy to knock together. I used to have hundreds of books lying around on the floor, you know what I mean? Just piled up every time somebody sent me a book or I bought a new one or something like that. I never read it. I just put it in the pile, you know, and I've still got hundreds of unread books. I thought, I've got to do this. So I literally went and got these 5 or 6 Billy bookcases, which can go up as high as your head, if you see what I mean. You know, there's various sizes. I knocked them all together so quickly, put them against the wall, and now I've got a library instead of an office. So, you know, I'm quite proud of myself about that.
Well, I'm sure you are. I can't quite imagine you putting furniture together by yourself.
Well, it's a few years since I did it. I don't think I'd be up for doing it again now, but it was when I used to have a brain that understood those sort of things, you know what I mean? Not
me. Do you know, the reason that IKEA furniture is going up in price is because of the price of wood.
Yeah.
The price of timber worldwide has literally gone through the roof.
Why is that?
And to do with shortage of supplies.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah. Well, they keep knocking down forests in Canada to be able to ship the wood across to the Drax Power Station in Yorkshire where they burn it. And I suppose that's increasing demand as well. Tell me,
doesn't help.
I know you're not a huge TV watcher and all that, but are you a follower or knowledgeable of The Crown TV series on Netflix?
Oh, a couple of my kids were really into it for a while, yeah. And I resisted it for ages.
Yeah.
And then I decided to sit down and watch a couple of episodes.
Right.
It's an interesting thing for me because my former cameraman on Earsay,
oh, yeah,
which was a show I did on Channel 4 back in the mid-80s,
right,
Andy Harris, he devised it and is executive producer of The Crown.
You're joking.
So I sort of resisted it for a while, yeah, for that reason.
Yeah.
He was also my boyfriend, but I never tell anybody.
Oh, really?
God. Anyway, the point of The Crown.
The secrets that are unveiled. The secrets.
Well, I know, just between you and me.
Just between you and me and our millions.
And our millions of listeners. Yeah. I think the thing about it is, you know, any film that is based on a true story,
yeah,
some of the detail and all of the dialogue is invented because those writers and those producers were not in the room,
yeah,
during whatever period it was when that film was being made, whoever it's about.
Yeah.
But I think the essence of these things is true. The basic sense of what the royal family is and was about,
yeah, yeah,
is true.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. The big row at the moment is that the next series includes a scene in which Charles allegedly goes to John Major, the Prime Minister at the time, and urges him to support the abdication of the Queen and the installation of Charles as king. And, of course, John Major's come out and said, it's all poppycock, it never happened. But actually, I don't know what the row's about. It's fiction.
Yeah, it is fiction. And so take another example, which I know a lot about. The Bohemian Rhapsody film. The so-called story of Freddie Mercury. Okay. Mm. I can give you endless examples of things that are made up in that. Mm. People think that because Brian May and Roger Taylor were the exec producers,
yes,
on that film, yes, that they would not let anything go into the film that isn't true. Therefore, the whole film is true. It isn't.
Yeah.
One tiny example. Mm. You've got a scene where just before Live Aid, mm, Freddie gathers the rest of the band together in the rehearsal studio, mm, and tells them that he's got AIDS.
Mm.
Well, that didn't happen. Right. He didn't get diagnosed for 2 more years.
No, and he didn't tell anybody either, did he?
Didn't tell anybody. But yeah, but the whole thing about a film, a feature film, is that it concertinas the truth.
Yes, exactly.
And that it brings it all into a sort of pressurized version.
Yeah.
And, of course, they have to beef it up every now and again. Mm. There was a series on television 2 or 3, maybe a bit longer, mm, years ago, mm, called Victoria, that was about Queen Victoria.
Right, yeah.
And it was written by a woman called Daisy Goodwin. Mm-hmm. I think it ran 2 series and then they didn't bring it back. But most of that storyline was invented.
Golly, amazing. But it's so long ago, nobody could...
But because it was about Queen, yeah, Victoria, people think that the whole thing was true. But if you think, yeah, right, nobody witnessed those conversations.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody witnessed them. Nobody wrote them down. So all of the dialogue in a film like that, yeah, has to be made up, doesn't it?
Yeah, I totally agree. Right. Okay, folks. That's it for another edition, another chapter, another exciting episode in Life on Planet Porky. Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. As ever, scintillating to hear your take on life and your adventures during your adventurous lifetime.
Thank you.
Yes, and folks, we'll be back with you same time next week. I remember one time, a guy called Bob somebody, can't remember his surname, he was the editor of the Express, he got sacked, and everybody hated him, so they all started mocking and reviling him. He went to the Mirror, and, you know, if they saw him in the street, they'd give him a hard time. And lo and behold, 4 months later, the proprietor had a change of mind and brought him back. So then half a dozen people who revelled in his demise were suddenly out. I mean, that's the sort of place Fleet Street was, you know? What about the pollution of thousands of cars standing, you know, still with their engines switched on hour after hour after hour? I mean,
it would have been much worse than what they were trying to prevent,
exactly,
I'm sure.
Exactly. Honestly, it drives me absolutely mad. You know, we're too tolerant in this country. I don't want a police state, and I don't want police walking around with batons and you know, cracking skulls of people who are sitting in the road with their hands glued to the tarmac. But I do want us to get, you know, very, very much more positive about trying to stop this thing happening. I say to them all the time, whenever I meet them, oh, I see, what is it, just stop oil. I tell you what, why don't you go to the world's biggest oil producer, that's Saudi Arabia, and why don't you sit in the streets in Riyadh and glue your hands to the tarmac there and find out what happens to you then? You would never be seen again, would you?
He was also my boyfriend, but I never tell anybody.
God.
Anyway, the point
the secrets
of the crash
that are unveiled. The secrets.
Well, I know just between you and me.
Just between you and me and our millions
and our millions of listeners. Yeah.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.